Great. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, the UCSF Center for AIDS Prevention, and the UCSF AIDS Research Institute, I'd like to warmly welcome you to this session on the Obama administration's response to global AIDS. We're pleased to have with us Ambassador Eric Goosby, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. My name is Peter Lawhorn. I'm the Executive Director of the Firelight Foundation. Before we begin, a quick word about the Council, which I'm sure some of you already know. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and that becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about the organization, you can visit the website at www.itsyourworld.org. In the unfortunate event that you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio and video online. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Now, before we begin, please take a moment and turn off all cell phones and other noise-making instruments. And while you do that, I'll let you know about two other events that are coming up. This Monday, August 2nd, please join the Council in welcoming the Acting Director of the Office of Iranian Affairs for the U.S. State Department, Jillian Burns. Ms. Burns will discuss U.S.-Iran relations and offer insight into the effectiveness of current sanctions. This event will be held at the World Affairs Council at 6 p.m. on the 2nd of August. Second event, on Thursday, August 5th, the Council is pleased to co-host Admiral Gary Ruffed, Chief of Naval Operations of the U.S. Navy, who will discuss the Navy's global influence and the emerging security environment. This event will be held at the Marines Memorial Theater at 6 p.m. Lastly, I'd encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed on your seats. Please hand them over to Council staff, and audience questions will be posed to our speaker during the second half of the program. Now, it's my honor to introduce our distinguished guest this evening. Ambassador Eric Goosby serves as the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, leading all U.S. government international HIV/AIDS efforts. In this role, Ambassador Goosby oversees implementation of the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, as well as the U.S. government relationship with the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Ambassador Goosby served as CEO and Chief Medical Officer of the Pangea Global AIDS Foundation from 2001 to 2009. And during the Clinton administration, he served as Deputy Director of the White House National AIDS Policy Office and Director of the Office of HIV/AIDS Policy at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Ambassador Goosby has over 25 years' experience with HIV/AIDS, ranging from his early years treating patients here at San Francisco General Hospital in the early days of the AIDS epidemic to engagement at the highest levels of policy leadership. Ambassador Goosby joins us tonight to outline the Obama administration's fight against global AIDS. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Eric Goosby.
Thank you.
You know, I guess I'll speak from here. It's really a pleasure to be with you tonight. It's a small enough group that I'll try to make this short and leave it open for questions that are more pertinent to what you're interested in hearing about. It's really nice to see a number of colleagues, friends, and mentors in the audience, and that's good to be always good to be back in San Francisco. I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you tonight. It's coming off of the meeting in Vienna that was last week, that was a pivotal point in kind of global discussion within the AIDS community around resources, around some good news with microbicides, looking at the impact of treatment on prevention, dropping seroprevalence rates, and benefiting from a herd immunity effect with a drop in infectivity. It also really was a real, I think, change in the way people perceived the opportunities out there for both care and especially for treatment. Realizing the extraordinary number of people who are infected on the planet, really at 33 million people, at 2.7 million a year, newly seroconverting estimate, with about 2 million people succumbing to the infection, we are in a continued accrual of more patients coming on board than is optimal. It has peaked and dropped, but we continue to still have a disproportionately large number of new infections each year to deal with. In virtually every country that HIV has been identified and mapped. I think that the Obama administration's response has picked up on continuing President Bush's commitment with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It now is in its seventh year, has had a impact on about 2.5 million people on antiretroviral therapy from PEPFAR alone. In combination with the Global Fund and a little bilateral salt and pepper throughout, it's up to a little over 4.5 million. I think that we've seen in sub-Saharan Africa and the 15 countries that were the original focus countries for PEPFAR, we've gone from about 50,000 people on antiretroviral therapy now to almost 3.5 million. I think that for those of you, and I know many of you here have been in sub-Saharan Africa pre these large programs, Global Fund and PEPFAR, being deployed, the 3 to 4 in bed were routine. The number of people in inpatient settings for opportunistic infections was the standard. The hospitals were overflowing. We were seeing more patients coming in with opportunistic infections than we could put on treatment. Those who were on treatment were either well off or well positioned and were on very fragile supply lines of antiretrovirals coming in through often providers. I know many of you in this room participated in bringing drugs in suitcases and giving people therapy for what ended up being something that you knew initially was not sustainable, but the choice was to watch them die. And I think that that remarkable realization with both Global Fund and PEPFAR that you could take a complicated disease that has difficult clinical picture, that is chronic and progressive, that frequently manifests with opportunistic infections, all of which look differently clinically, that have different diagnostic needs to diagnose them and different treatments, that you could take all of these complexities and create a medical delivery system that is responsive to this many people in this short a period of time has startled, I think, many people in health development, in both the countries and in the multilateral world. This, when we started this work in the late 90s and the early 2000s, the mantra was that this really wasn't doable, that pilots were possible, but that taking a pilot to scale was not something that we were going to see. I think PEPFAR has very definitively shown that when resources are made available and they're concentrated and when they are matched with hard outcomes, both in process and impact, you can demonstrate a direct relationship to the resource and the ability to bring people into care and to retain them over time. With very, very low rates of resistance emerging. We have better retention rates than San Francisco General or Johns Hopkins, Harvard medical schools by a long shot. Our retention rates in inner city medical schools is anywhere from 50 to 70%, depending on the group you want to identify. We're looking at 85 to 95% retention. Overall, we're looking at resistance rates of 1 to 3%, depending on the country you're in. And it's largely because of the evolution of availability of antiretrovirals really allowed us to start with three drugs instead of what happened in the United States, Western Europe, Canada, Australia. We started with monotherapy, went to dual therapy, and put a lot of resistant organism out there as the primary or as the organism that the individual was infected with initially. So we have much higher rates of resistance in this country and Western Europe than we're seeing in Africa. And that seems to be remaining stable. So I think that the thinking has evolved to what, as we mature now into our seventh year of these programs, we want to look for sustainability. We want these programs to be available to the populations we're serving for 20 to 30 years or longer. To do that, we feel that movement of management, oversight, troubleshooting, accountability needs to move back toward the country. Country includes the government, ministries of health, both public and private sector, but it also includes civil society, indigenous NGOs that are present in these countries and have now, after 7 years of this and 10 years of the Global Fund, there's a cadre of expertise that has developed that indeed can do south-south technical assistance. They're developing the ability to do good monitoring and evaluation, to not just do it, but to act after analysis of it on the problems that are highlighted. So the Obama administration, in thinking of the maturation of these programs, has come up with the idea of the Global Health Initiative. Now, this isn't rocket science. It's really an integrative exercise that takes vertical programming in the United States government and PEPFAR, President's Malaria Initiative, the immunization programs, maternal and child health, family planning, reproductive health programs, and puts a kind of aggregates the services in a service site, be it a clinic or a hospital, and allows the provider who's seen the person with HIV/AIDS in front of them to now respond to the other needs of this same patient in those other areas, expanding their capability to diagnose and treat, to move into maternal and child health, family planning, immunizations for the children, then to have a cadre of country-dependent, determined primary care or disease, chronic progressive diseases that are relevant. Hypertension, diabetes, coronary or artery disease seem to be recurrent. Some countries are looking at cancer, cervical cancer in particular, and prostate cancer. But to take that kind of essential service package that the ministry and the country self-define and have that as part of the package that an HIV/AIDS platform with doctors, nurses, laboratories, procurement distribution systems can easily add to their toolbox of what they offer and how they respond to the needs of the patient population who's already in front of them. In maternal and child health and family planning platforms, they would expand into HIV/AIDS testing capability, staging, and in some instances, putting those patients on antiretroviral therapy from a maternal and child health platform. The prevention of mother-to-child transmission, now in HIV/AIDS platforms, largely in small hospital or hospital-based delivery expectations. Moving that into a home-based strategy or looking at taking maternal and child health platforms and adding maternal prevention of maternal-to-child transmission strategies on a maternal and child health platform as opposed to just on HIV/AIDS platforms. Those types of additions, the cross-training of service capability to expand your ability to respond to these diseases, the protocols that would be developed, identifying outcomes that will allow us to look at drops in death rates from both maternal and child family planning issues, but neglected tropical diseases from immunizations, from tuberculosis, continuing the malaria surge. All, I think, will put us in a position where we begin to do more services in the same already existing up and running service sites that the United States government has put such an effort toward. I think a big theme in the Vienna conference was the resources that the United States are putting toward this. We make up, and this is the Kaiser Family Foundation's data that was reported last week, about 58% of the global health effort. In AIDS, HIV, we frequently are 95% of the HIV/AIDS effort in the partner countries that we're working in. We often see partner country budgets dip with their HIV/AIDS allotment because we're putting resources in, so they move it to education or they move it to immunizations. It's a logical move, but as we now have moved into developing this kind of second phase of PEPFAR, we've created a process that we call a partnership framework, where we look at a five-year period, the next 5 years, and in dialogue, a different, more intense dialogue with ministries of health and with civil society, sometimes using the country coordinating mechanism of the Global Fund, are planning and making commitments to, we'll do this over the next 5 years, you do this, country, public sector, and private sector, you do the following. These agreements are not binding, but they are formally engaged with. Our ambassador in country, or the Secretary Clinton, or I will come and to the country and sign it with usually Minister of Health, with Minister of Finance, and about 50% of the time with the President of the country. These commitments in the partnership framework really are a tool to move our attention to trying to shift more of the continuums of care and services, especially in prevention and treatment, to more public sector involvement or a hybrid of public sector NGO involvement. For those concentrated epidemics with high-risk populations, men who have sex with men, injection drug users, sex worker-driven epidemics, those populations need special consideration and strategies to identify them, test and retain them in care over time. Injection drug users need a strategy that acknowledges the natural history of their addiction really must include and accommodate them falling back into active drug use, and to have a strategy that does not lose them during that period but retains them, so when they are ready to reengage in addressing the addiction, they're captured and their medical problems around HIV and TB are not ignored in that interface. As a result, we have been able to kind of frame the Global Health Initiative as this expansion of care services within the existing platforms that are available, but only to look at access and retention strategies over time for the population, while at the same time we increase and expect increased involvement from ministries of health, concentrating our technical assistance on them. I'm going to end with just a comment on where we're headed in the future. The Global Health Initiative really is an integrative process exercise that will take USG programs and shuffle their service capabilities together to then move them out on a maternal and child health, as I said, or an HIV/AIDS platform. We also need to integrate with multilateral organizations, in particular Global Fund, to some degree UNITAID, to give us an access to those resources, to the country planning process that will, I think, better position these programs to be more embedded in the public sector service portfolios that are that we are working in and amongst, to embed these programs, to have them now realistically continue with USG funding. We don't expect any country to suddenly be able to pay for these services. We're now looking at somewhere around $400 per patient per year for antiretroviral therapy, for monitoring labs, for follow-up, and support services that are needed. We started at $1,700 U.S. dollars per person per year. So the savings that have happened within care and treatment have been remarkable. We have dropped our care requirement because people are getting on cotrimoxazole, people are getting on antiretrovirals. The number of opportunistic infections have dropped precipitously. We've cleared out many of the capital city teaching hospital wards from an inpatient main dominated response to an outpatient dominated response in most of the big cities. That's pushing out into the rural areas. So I think that this integrative process that we're talking about with USG, with the Global Health Initiative, needs to be complemented with integration with the Global Fund. So over the next 6 months to a year, we will merge our planning processes for PEPFAR and the Global Fund, where their resources and our resources truly have an opportunity to be additive, to look for areas of efficiency, which will be large. We'll have probably 25-35% savings that we'll identify from this exercise. And then matched with a strengthening of our prevention activities to target high-risk groups instead of making blanket population messaging the dominant mode, which is currently what it is, moving our toolbox of prevention interventions to cover blood safety, needles for populations that would benefit male circumcision, and then to have targeted messaging going to high-risk groups who are participating in the highest risk behaviors. Condom distribution, referral, family planning, and reproductive health, especially in spacing of pregnancies, becomes an important intervention. And trying to combine these prevention modalities on the same population for a combination prevention activity will only be, I think that PEPFAR is uniquely positioned to study it and look at the impact that this will have. But as we move into both a different dialogue with our country partners in the ministry, and as we look at a Global Fund change in the way we do our planning, we are really looking at significant changes in the way the USG and the PEPFAR teams and country, on top of this Global Health Initiative expanding on it, will really be a transformative force in, I think, development and health development specifically. Finally, the President and Secretary Clinton's vision of where we're going with this work is really to start the dialogue around a shared responsibility. It's not all USG funded. We can't be the Department and Ministry of Health for each country we're in. But we can push our multilateral colleagues in WHO and UNAIDS, in the World Bank, to play strategic additive roles in planning, strategic planning, budget development, monitoring and evaluation, impact evaluation, and in kind of developing a skill set for our ministries of health that allow them to play the oversight role that is so desperately needed, for them to be the convening influence for these divergent funding lines from the Global Fund to PEPFAR. To have a planning process that is strong enough to carry a definition of unmet need, to prioritize that unmet need for the populations that especially don't have a voice at the table, is really what this will become. And I'm proud to say that both the President and the Secretary of State are eager for this dialogue to move to the G8, the G20, the UNGAS coming up at the end of the summer, the MDG summit that will also be discussed, looking at maternal and child health and child survival with HIV, AIDS, and TB. The interplay is a huge overlapping populations in need. But to really put a basement of healthcare on the planet for the first time, to start those discussions around whether or not giving and responding to the health needs of people as a human right need is really something that the planet is ready to not only talk about but to embrace. So I'll stop there and we can take some questions and focus on what people would like to hear more of.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Please join me. Now, just to remind people, you can be writing down questions, those of you who haven't given some for the moment. Let me exercise the moderator's prerogative and just ask one to start. What worries you the most? What keeps you up at night? And what would you like to be able to solve that seems currently beyond your means?
Well, I think the burden of the knowledge of a clearer understanding of what the unmet need is. The movement from 200 to 350 is the trigger for initiating antiretrovirals, triples the number of people who now are in need of treatment. Waiting until a person is at 200 is not as good as starting a person at 350. So that realization of the huge cost to respond to that unmet need. I guess the second issue that I would say worries me is understanding the tension that is in our USG colleagues who are implementing these programs in country, our NGO colleagues who are frequently in the leadership role in implementing in PEPFAR-funded projects, the tension that's present in shifting the focus from a emergency response to one that develops systems that are more sustainable is something that are those who are in the field don't gravitate naturally to. And we've had to be prescriptive in explaining why we feel this is important and insisting that we move down this road. And these are people that if you met them, they would be the salt of the earth, you know, the second two-term Peace Corps people who dedicated their lives, made huge sacrifices to put themselves in situations that are hardship and even risky, but really do not have the history of engaging with countries that tells them that this is going to be a fruitful endeavor. So developing a TA strategy for that has been a difficult lift, and we're kind of in the middle of that now.
Great.
Yeah.
We wish you well with that. Mm-hmm. I have, in your first response about the cost of unmet need, there are a number of questions that came up that are related to that. One question, is it realistic to think that within 5 to 10 years, Uganda, say, will be able to take on the burden of providing antiretroviral drugs? What's the sustainability of the work that's being done? And a related question about countries in conflict and crisis. Are there special arrangements that ought to be made for countries that aren't going to be able to bear the burden themselves?
Well, in terms of Uganda or really any country you name, Botswana, Namibia, Nigeria, South Africa have resources that are either present or are kind of emerging that are realistic to anticipate will be able to alter the contribution that the country's making. Angola, with the gas having been present, less so. The country is not quite as mature in its developing its response and getting those resources to move into filling unmet need in the public sector. I think that we have no misconceptions that our partner countries are going to suddenly be able to put the money needed to cover these services on the table. But we will expect and do expect them not to drop their contribution. That they, I just got back from Kampala, where there was a, over the weekend, an African Union discussion where countries were reconsidering the 15% commitment they made to put their budgets toward healthcare, not HIV specific, but to healthcare in general. And the inability of most countries in sub-Saharan Africa to achieve that, and whether or not they should change the percent or recommit to moving towards it. That expectation having been reconfirmed a number of times and then reconsidered, but it's an expectation that we hold. My ability to get resources from Congress is impaired when countries drop their money, and it's difficult to explain. At the same time, we in PEPFAR understand that we will not hold populations and country hostage to try to force their country leadership into responding to the unmet needs of their people. We're in that position in virtually every country we're in. Because of the nature of this type of aid, it's not roads, it's not building schools, but there is an ethical commitment you make to that person who is receiving the antiretroviral drugs that you're paying for. It's different. It's a real commitment that we are honoring and will continue to honor and not pull the rug out from under. But at the same time, have put very clear expectations out there to legislatures and to presidents, ministers of finance, that this is an expectation. This is about 6 months old. We have virtually seen a positive response in every country in whom we've had this discussion. They get it. They see the difficult situation it puts me in with the appropriators, and they also see the economic decline as something that is pushing other bilateral programs, especially European programs, out. We have been able to sustain. Other countries have dropped their amount, but also their program. So I think not an unrealistic view. We will expect their management oversight, problem solving, rapid assessment of problems, all to increase. And we're setting up technical assistance in each country to help enhance that capacity expansion.
A couple of realpolitik questions. The first, what's the political advantage to the U.S. Of the work of PEPFAR? And second, which you just touched on, when the U.S. government is negotiating partnership agreements, what is it looking for from countries, and what are they looking for from the states, and where may they disagree?
Well, I think the countries are generally looking for money, but they also have been very appreciative of the capacity that they have experienced in their own ability to plan strategically, to develop continuums of care and services for HIV-TB co-infected, for specific populations within the geographic area, understanding how the virus moves through populations, setting up a surveillance system. They've benefited significantly from it and are very grateful for that. I think that the real benefit is that we have addressed one of the worst, negatively impacting diseases of our time, and gone to the areas that were epicenters of the disease, and not have this mismatch of disease burden and response. Being in your northern countries, the treatment was much more available. So there's a lot of gratitude. When you stabilize an individual, you stabilize with antiretrovirals and treatment. You bring stability to the family. You stop the mother or father from dying and creating an orphan. PEPFAR is taking care of 10 million orphans now, 5 million from kindergarten through their 24th year, food, housing, education, job training, kind of social skills, and try to follow them into their young adulthood. It is, Peter and I were talking before before this talk on about how much of a learning curve that has been for me, because I had not done work in orphans and vulnerable children before this. But a huge contribution there in social stability. The family stabilized, the community is stabilized, and the country is stabilized because of it. When you had this level of death and dying going on, the instability and opportunity for infiltration of terrorist activity and thinking was rich. And I think that there's no question that this intervention has made a huge difference in that. The strata of society that was most impacted were your mobile males with money. That included your faculties of schools, your professions and medicine and law and engineering, in the military. We had countries that were and are still reeling from the impact of this disease. It remains the leading killer. It remains the leading killer for pregnant women. In the 15 to 49-year-old age group, it again, for males and females, remains number one in most countries. In a couple of countries, it's moving to number two. So I think the social stability is the huge positive impact. The goodwill that it's created would be the second impact that I would say, not just in the country in which we work, but also in European and Eastern European countries and the way the United States is viewed. Secretary Clinton has identified PEPFAR as the face that she wants the health diplomatic arm of her diplomacy, defense, and development trio, the three Ds, as part of to dominate the face of how and what the American people put forward in our interactions with other countries, to have that development and specifically health development be that piece. So I think the goodwill is there, but it also is socially a stabilizing factor.
And there was a part of that question about disagreement or any tensions between the U.S. and the countries?
There is tension around money. In some countries, we are decreasing the amount of money. Ethiopia, in South Africa, in Botswana, in Namibia. We are reaching 85-90% in all but South Africa of the people who need antiretrovirals to be on them. The PMTCT numbers are 85-90% in those countries. The countries are increasing their percent that they're putting toward HIV/AIDS and health in general, but they also have enough resources to increase the amount that they're contributing specifically to HIV/AIDS care. So in a specific agreement with the country and an agreed upon decline in USG resources without a drop in programming, we are able to supplant their resources, but to add, keep ours additive as we withdraw our numbers and move those resources to other countries that don't have them, like Zimbabwe. We have been able to drop in all of those countries, and the countries are happy to be able to do it and contribute to kind of adjacent countries' burden of disease. So I haven't been in an argument with anyone around, mm-hmm. we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to do it? Here's mm-hmm. the trajectory. We're going to do it. Do you agree to that? And we've moved forward nicely with that kind of pattern.
So the international discussions may be simple. How about the domestic ones?
The domestic discussions are there's largely a low level of appreciation of what PEPFAR is. Mm-hmm. The impact that it's had on the numbers is poorly understood. People think that we put a disproportionate amount of money into development in general and view it as something that's taking up you know, huge percent of our GNP when actually it's a very small percent. And we get a lot of goodwill for the money spent. It's also the right thing to do for the richest country in the world to have a strategy that moves resources to countries that are resource poor. And I think the American people should be very proud of what this program does and many of the programs that are vertical programs looking at health-related issues in USAID and in HHS. There's no other country that even comes close to it. We are, and this is something that I didn't know before doing this work, we do it because we can. Other countries can't do it. They don't have the money to put resources toward this effort. We do things that never get touted, advertised, or kind of counted, except for those people who are working in the field or directly benefit from them. I think we need to get better at that.
Mm-hmm.
I think our dialogue with appropriators need to include that more in explaining to them the impact that these resources create. They continue to reverberate because you save a life, you save a family, you save a community that just keeps on giving that individual back. The person continues to work. They continue to contribute. It's quite a ripple that we've created with this program and others like it. We don't talk about it enough.
I think that's a good diagnosis of the communication mm-hmm. challenge. Now, the treatment is something that I think everyone in the audience is going to be interested in. Everyone here committed to global issues. What can be done to turn that perception around?
Well, I think our leadership, Secretary Clinton and the President, need to be more verbal about it. They need to take these expectations to G8, G20 discussions, UN General Assembly discussions. Our bilateral discussions generally with the Secretary includes discussion around PEPFAR when it's a PEPFAR country, or our global programs in health when it isn't. She sees that as not just a goodwill generator, but a strong platform off of which to find common needs and agendas. She's used it to her advantage to strengthen relationships in most all the bilateral discussions that I've participated with her in. It sticks better than a road or I can get you some money to build mm-hmm. something,
mm-hmm.
Kind of writing a check. It's more collegial. It's more joining on and in their problem and working with them to solve it. It brings in our academic institutions in a way that also galvanizes and deepens the roots of those relationships. So I think mm-hmm. we are just learning how to talk about it, though, and to our appropriators to explain to them the benefit that this really does afford and why they should continue to put resources towards it.
Great.
Yeah.
A couple of questions here about geographic focus. One asking about Eastern Europe and the importance of the epidemic there and whether PEPFAR is paying attention to that. Another about the Global Fund and the a question about the China being the fourth largest recipient of Global Fund funding at $500 million. Do you have a point of view on that?
Well, boy, it's funny that it's come up a number of times in the last few days. You know, I do, and I understand the position that one gravitates to say that why should we support a country that has enough money to support itself? and it gets down to really understanding what the resources are there for, both our resources in PEPFAR, but also the Global Fund resources, specifically in your question. They're there for unmet need. They're not really targeting countries, they're targeting unmet need. It was a pot to put resources and make them available to needs that countries that didn't have resources couldn't mount, but it was also for the people whose needs were not being met, too. And Russia, for example, was an early benefited early from Global Fund and then decided to pay back the Global Fund with the promise that they would continue programming. Their epidemic, as you know, is driven by mostly injection drug users with a significant component for men who have sex with men. And they continued all the treatment programs, but they stopped the needle exchange and drug treatment programs and didn't fund it for about $27 million. Paid back the rest to the Global Fund, and now they want to move into the donor category. The Global Fund decided, the board decided, to continue funding the NGOs that delivered the harm reduction services and drug treatment and link them to the medical treatment that was continued by the Russian government. That's an example, and China, of a situation where you have resources that politically would not be made available to marginalized populations in the country, but could be accessed by either civil society or even the country with less political baggage by having Global Fund pay for it and not the Russian budget pay for it to respond to the needs of injection drug users. China is doing that with injection drug users and sex workers. I worked for the last 6 or 7 years since, I guess, 2003 in China, working with the government to set up drug treatment programs linked to HIV/AIDS, TB programs. And it was needle exchange and methadone treatment. It works well when it's linked. You retain patients in care over time. You have multiple opportunities to deliver prevention messages, to get monitoring bloods, to get them back in for adherence issues with antiretrovirals. When the system is linked, it works very well. I think that to withdraw those services in China would hold that population hostage to try to tweak the government into giving more resources toward this effort. And I see it as an ethical dilemma. We are not responding to met need. We are responding to unmet need in China, large unmet need. The government either can't or isn't willing to engage with it, but the Global Fund affords a conduit of resources to access that it would not be there otherwise. So I'm, you know, mm-hmm. I've got that kind of just worry with it. Appropriators on the Hill feel that, in fact, most everybody feels that countries like China should not really be recipients of Global Fund money.
Is there a subtext to that, that the Global Fund, in a sense, is a better channel for these sorts of edgy funding to particular marginalized groups than, say, bilateral channels, the U.S. government?
I think they really do afford that that advantage. They give you a political cover. They give you distance. For those organizations, foundations, and other bilaterals that have not put any money toward treatment because they don't want to get caught in the black hole of treatment, you know, I've heard it described as the treatment mortgage, is understandable, but this gives them a conduit to put resources toward that effort that they're not kind of ethically linked to the actual patient putting the pills in their mouth.
Okay.
So I think it broadens the pot.
Yeah. Question about PEPFAR and the role of human rights. And specifically in the early days of PEPFAR, there was an emphasis on abstinence, an emphasis on religious organizations. How has that evolved, and where would you say human rights are in the principles of PEPFAR funding?
Well, I think they've always been central to the PEPFAR funding in the ideology that may have driven some of the decisions would be what I think we could take issue with. I think you could disagree with the ideology, but the motivation was a genuine motivation to respond to unmet need with the Bush administration. The abstinence be faithful predominance is not evidence-based. And we have moved to evidence-based prevention strategies. The abstinence works when it works. Being faithful works when it works. But for those individuals who especially are in high-risk repetitive behavior, discordant couples, et cetera, condom availability becomes critical. It's an abandonment of the patient to not have those services available to them. If you as an entity don't feel that you can refer or have that service available on site, we have to come up with a solution to meet that need. In now 30 or 40 different discussions with different organizations that fall into the AB category without C, we've been successful at putting C either on site or adjacent to physically their site where people can truly get the condom in the same day that the question's risen. Where we haven't, it's created, and there's only been two cases where we haven't been able to do that. There have been legislative language put into appropriations language in the reauthorization in 2008 that prevents defunding based on not referring. And we've taken a strong look at that. But in terms of the way this has played out, kind of at a 30,000-foot level, a huge shift toward evidence-based core package expectation in each country. Anything else you do, you've got to justify from the EPI or the demographics or the opportunity. And we have seen just naturally a shifting away from a dominant AB prevention strategy.
Well, that's a segue into a question here about the difference in style and approach between PEPFAR and the Global Fund. Mm-hmm. Emphasis on evidence basis, also an emphasis with the Global Fund on technical assistance. The question here, if you compare PEPFAR and the Global Fund with the Global Fund not spending tons of money on technical assistance, mm-hmm. do you get more bang for the buck from the Global Fund than from PEPFAR?
I would say PEPFAR is more efficient and is able to deploy more rapidly, know what we did, and able to demonstrate outcomes more clearly related to the resources in deployed. Kind of cause and effect, kind of. The idea of country ownership is the right idea, and the Global Fund does that better. It created a country coordinating mechanism, a CCM, which is like a planning body that has the providers who are delivering care around it, some multilaterals, and some bilaterals sit at the table. It's convened usually by the country Ministry of Health, but does not play the oversight management kind of dealing with problem, evaluating, monitoring, evaluation, let alone impact evaluation that it is charged to do and expected to do, but rarely does. Mm-hmm. So I think the best model now is moving PEPFAR more toward country ownership, moving PEPFAR more toward targeted technical assistance to both the ministry and the CCM mm-hmm. to play the oversight role it should, or abandon that model because these people all have full-time jobs doing something else, mm-hmm. And create a management capability in-country, perhaps by the principal recipient or another with a local area, the fiduciary person that's there who's largely just an accountant function. But to create an oversight mechanism that truly can play that role. I see the Global Fund and PEPFAR as moving into a hybrid of both. That's the future. We will save more money, get more people under the curve of treatment at the same level of funding by doing that than if we do the two separate. So I think the future is the merging of both.
Mm-hmm. And to the extent that your role allows you to, if you were going to look 10 years into the future in your crystal ball, what do you think will be the governance of AIDS funding and of the fight against AIDS?
I think there'll be, in the 5 to 10 year frame, a small cadre of countries that we, as the U.S. government, other bilaterals, actually move more toward a basket funding strategy, where we pool our money, keeping all the transparency and audit need intact, accountable for it, outcome, impact, et cetera, but that the country is maybe not generating the money, but they are defining unmet need, they're prioritizing unmet need, they're making the allocation decisions, they are, and our work, our resources are expanding the public capability as well as the private NGO capability to complete continuums of care and prevention services that respond and change to the evolving needs of the populations we're targeting. That, I think, is the future of where we need to go. There'll be a smaller group of those countries that fall into that category. Then there'll be a larger group of countries that we continue to not put resources readily available to them, but continue to work through parallel systems of care through NGO strategies. As we have epidemics that are driven by high-risk groups, MSM and IDU in particular, to a lesser degree sex worker and transgender, those populations would be targeted, and NGO strategies may dominate the response for those communities. Okay. Over public sector.
Great. And where do you see us heading in terms of prevention in the next decade?
I think we're really happy about the microbicide trial, and we're happy about the three antibodies for the vaccine that look like they stimulate a cell-mediated response that's effective in protecting. I think that that our approach now is has been over the last year to go back to the epi, the demographics, look at unmet need, look at the populations that are most actively participating in the highest risk behaviors, and target them first, to have a core safe blood supply matched with high impact prevention interventions that would include biomedical, like male circumcision, PMTCT, the ability to diagnose sexually transmitted diseases early and treat them, to decrease transmission, to look at the kind of core toolbox as everybody gets this funded, and then anything else that diverges from that core high impact list menu has to be justified for countries to kind of go into. Right now, the AB predominance and the kind of broad population-based messaging on billboards and radio has a role, but it's disproportionate to the impact right now in terms of the resources going toward those strategies. We're trying to push it back to the core high impact, and then everything else peripherally. I'm thrilled about the pre-exposure prof, post-exposure prof, and the possibility of a test-and-treat strategy looking like we may, although the cost considerations are rate-limiting here, the fact that they do work would afford this strategy for test-and-treat to high-risk groups like that you could target, if not going to the broader strategy to treat everybody. But the resources for that would be $33 million plus the 2.7 times the cost of care, which are, you know, really overwhelming.
What sort of messages would you like people to walk out of here tonight with, and what sort of a renewed commitment?
Well, I guess that this continues to be a central priority for the Obama administration. The economic decline has decreased the resources available to go towards it in the first year, in the second year, but we're hoping and anticipate that in the third, fourth, fifth year, and further on out to the eighth, we will be in a position to catch up. three-year flat funding and decrease in funding in the U.S. government was only the defense strategy, strategic defense initiatives. PEPFAR was included in that, and we went up about 3 to 3.5% in this last funding cycle. But we have accelerated our ability to bring people into care and onto antiretrovirals because we've gotten much more efficient with the resources we have, like a third of the cost now than it was 3 years ago. We've gone from the 1.7 at the beginning of the Obama administration, and we're now up to 2.5 million people on antiretrovirals. So we've accelerated the accrual rates. The New York Times article around Uganda, which played for months as an example of PEPFAR capping and withdrawing care, was not what occurred there. It was an example of many of really global fund resources, other bilateral resources not getting into Uganda, decreasing the enrollment of patients and placement on antiretrovirals in those clinics, and displacing doubling the accrual rate in the PEPFAR, 140 PEPFAR clinics in Uganda. Seven of those clinics saturated, and he and the reporter reported on those, where there was no more PEPFAR money to put people on antiretrovirals. But it was just a temporary problem because of an annual budget that they exceeded the budget that we had put, they had agreed on to put people on antiretrovirals. But we've been able to go back in and move resources around and unplug the queue that was there. All those patients are now getting put on antiretrovirals and figuring out how to bring the Global Fund resources into country that had been delayed. So we've unplugged that. Those types of problems are going to happen more and more, but it by no means was because of a lack of intention or commitment to putting people on antiretroviral therapy and treatment with the Obama administration, as a lot of the accusations were focused on.
And maybe one final question that's dear to my own foundation's heart. Will we see the end of vertical transmission and the end of infection at birth by 2015?
Well, we will see it very rapidly, and PEPFAR and the Global Fund will be the main conduits that fund it. We have it as our highest priority to move there. Every multilateral organization now is crying for the elimination of vertical transmission. We believe that we will be pretty close. If not on it, we will know where our bottlenecks are by 2015.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I'll say that.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Hi, Jay. How are you?
Good to see you.
It's good to see you.
I was glad you mentioned.